Oh, come, party faithful,
loyal campaign workers.
Oh, come ye to George E. Bush's Washington. Take a position in his administration.
Executive assistant,
or deputy director, or undersecretary. Reaganomics, kindus et gentlus, soon lose. Medum malitum, humile ponte laetium, decrisium dispendum, increasium defensum, noresium detaxum.
Okay, all you Latin scholars out there, this is your big chance. Please sing along.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining up with us, we're listening to What is Progress? Author Ronald Wright says understanding humanity's pattern of progress and disaster will help us avoid the collapse of civilization as we know it. Ronald is interviewed by Pia Chotopati.
So what I suggest is that the precautionary principle has to be brought into play here, that before we deploy any new and potentially dangerous technology indiscriminately, very careful, controllable experiments should be conducted over quite a long period of time to see what the downsides are likely to be. And you know, a couple of technologies that we're just developing now that come to mind here are genetic modification, particularly of our food, which could very well threaten the entire basis of world agriculture, and nanotechnology. You know, the some people call it the gray goo nightmare, where you know you start making these little tiny molecular level machines, and they find out these little things might start reproducing themselves, and eventually we're knee deep in them, and they've destroyed the Earth. I mean, it sounds like sort of crazy science
fiction, sci-fi, yeah.
But it actually is a realistic fear. So, as our technologies get more complex, and they're getting more complex all the time, and as they get more powerful, and they're certainly getting more powerful all the time, the potential dangers are also that much greater, and that is why we have to exercise the precautionary principle under a system of social control. And I would argue that that has to be overseen by a world body so that there's a level playing field for everyone everywhere, so that you can't sort of move to some country where a dictatorship and a sort of sweatshop economy and avoid being regulated. This has to be dealt with on a world level, as do just about all of the problems we face at the moment.
Are you seeing that starting to happen?
There are signs of it starting to happen in some places, but there are also very powerful forces arrayed against it. I mean, I think that the free trade agreements that have been a big feature of the past 20 to 30 years, in some areas, privilege the power of money over social and environmental consequences. I think that's a very bad thing. On the other hand, there are other trading associations. The European Union would perhaps be the best example. It began as a free trade association. It's now moving into something bigger, something more like a federation. It's still very much a work in progress in that sense. But it achieved more of a balance between the interests of business, the interests of labor, and the interests of nature. Of course, it's a mistake to think that the interests of nature are different from our interests. In the long run, healthy nature means healthy people. That is the balance that we have to maintain. If we just let consumerism rip for the sake of short-term stuff and short-term gain, we will wear out nature just as so many civilizations of the past have done in their little areas, but we will do it worldwide.
What is the wake-up call for us? You wrote this book a few years ago, and you say, you know, some people are listening, there seems to be a little bit of movement, but yet I think almost universally humanity still views progress as a good thing, that moving forward it means progress technologically and so forth. What's the wake-up call that's needed?
If you look at the graph between world temperature and the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over the past 150 years, the two are in lockstep. It's quite clear that the temperature is rising due to the release of carbon dioxide and that most of that release is due to us. And we know that that is going to lead to disaster if it continues. And it's not, I mean, here in Canada, of course, it's easy to think that a little bit of warming wouldn't be a bad thing. You know, it's a hard sell to complain about temperature rising a couple of degrees. It sounds like a good thing, but of course it's not as if it's going to just warm gently and nicely. What's happening is that the graph is going to start going all over the place. We're going to have, you know, hailstorms in July, we're going to have catastrophic floods in the middle of winter, that kind of thing. And if we allow it to get to the point where this threatens the world's major breadbaskets and we start losing crops simultaneously in, say, more than one of those big breadbaskets, then we're going to see world famine on a scale that has never been seen before.
Okay, Ronald, so we're going to have to leave it there on that dire note tonight, but we'll pick up our conversation again tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Well, let me tell you of the story of a man named Charlie on a tragic and fateful day. He put 10 cents in his pocket, kissed his wife and family, went to ride on the MTA. Well, did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned.
What a pity.
He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned.
Charlie handed in his dime at the Kendall Square station, and he changed for Jamaica Plain. When he got there, the conductor told him one more nickel. Charlie couldn't get off of that train.
But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned.
Poor old Charlie.
He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned.
Now all night long, Charlie rides through the station crying, what will become of me? How can I afford to see my sister in Chelsea or my cousin in Roxbury?
But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned.
Charlie's wife goes down to the Scully Square station every day at 2:15. And through the open window she hands Charlie a sandwich as the train comes rumbling through.
But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned.
Take it, baby.
Citizens of Boston, don't you think it's a scandal how the people have to pay and pay? Fight the fare increase, vote for George O'Brien, get for Charlie off the MTA.
Or else he'll never return, no, he'll never return, and his fate is still unlearned.
Just like Paul.
He may ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's the man who'll never return. He's the man who'll never return. He's the man who'll never return.
Coming up next, Tom Hanks makes the Vassar commencement speech of 2005.
Thank you, Fran, for that introduction. As Milton's wife said to Milton of Milton's Paradise Lost, it seems a little long to me, but I liked it. Not long ago, I was reading about the problem of gridlock on the freeways of Southern California, the traffic jams which cripple the city, stranding millions and laying waste to time and energy and the environment. Gridlock is as serious and as impenetrable a problem as any we face, a dilemma without cure, without solution, like everything else in the world, it seems. Some smart folks concocted a computer simulation of gridlock to determine how many cars should be taken off the road to turn a completely jammed and stilled highway into a free-flowing one. how many cars must be removed from that commute until a 20-mile drive takes 25 minutes instead of 2 hours. The results were startling. 4 cars needed to be removed from that virtually stuck highway to free up that simulated commute. 4 cars out of each 100 cars. 4 cars per 100 cars. 4 autos out of every 100 autos. 40 cars from each 1,000. 400 out of 10,000. 4 cars out of 100 are not that many. 2 cars out of every 50, 1 driver out of every 25 drivers. Now, if this simulation is correct, it is the most dramatic definition in earthly science and human nature of how a simple choice will make a jaw-dropping difference to our world. Call it the power of 4. 1 commuter in your neighborhood could put the rush back into rush hour. So, if merely 4 people out of 100 can make gridlock go away by choosing not to use their car, imagine the other changes that can be wrought by just 4 of us, 4 of you, out of 100. Take 100 musicians in a depressed port city in northern England. Choose John, Paul, George, and Ringo. You have Hey Jude. Take 100 computer geeks in Redmond, Washington. Send 96 of them home. And the remainder is called Microsoft. Take the power of 4 and apply it to any and every area of your concern. Politics. 4 votes swung from 100 into another 100 is the difference between gaining control and losing clout. Culture. 2 ticket buyers out of 50 can make a small, odd film profitable. Economics. By boycotting a product, 1 consumer out of 25 can move that product to the back of the shelf and eventually off it altogether. 4 out of 100 is minuscule and yet can be the great lever of the tipping point. The power of 4 is the difference between helplessness and help, H-E-L-P, a 4-letter word. Like some others with many meanings. The graduating class of 2005 can claim with perhaps more credibility than any other class in history that during its 4 years of college, the world went crazy. In the fall of 2001, our planet Earth, the United States of America, were different sorts of places in tone, in tolerance, in peace and war, in ideas and in ideals than they are on this spring day in 2005. These past years have been extraordinary in the express rate of change, well beyond the usual standards of culture and well above the personal watermarks you have stamped as college students. As college graduates, you now live in a brand new world with new versions of political upheaval, global pandemic, world war, and religious polarization, the likes of which have rarely visited our planet all at once, and thank God for that. Today's main purpose is to celebrate your entering into society, but the fact is you have all been very much steeped in it already, Poughkeepsie being the proxy and microcosm of the whole wide world. None of you were untouched by the events in September of your freshman year, none unaffected by the ideological movements of local and geopolitics since. All of you have been staring your individual fate and our collective future right in the eye for the last 4 years. The common stereotype would have you today, cap in the air, parchment in hand, asking yourself, what do I do now? You, the class of 2005, had already had many, many moments during your time at Vassar when you asked yourself that question. You might have added the word hell to some such 4-letter word to that phrase, what the hell do I do now? In which case, today might not be all that different from other days on campus, except your parents are here, they might take you out for better food. On commencement day, speechmakers are expected to offer advice as though you need any, as though anything said today could aid your making sense of our one damn thing after another world. But things are too confused, too loud, too dangerous to make advice an option. You need to hear something much more relevant on this day. you need to hear the most important message thus far in the third millennium. You need to hear a maxim so simple, so clear, and so evocative that no one could misconstrue its meaning or miss its weighty issue. So here goes. It's not a statement, but it's a request. It's not a bit of advice, but it's a plea. In fact, it's a single four-letter word. It's a verb and a noun, which takes into account the reality of your 4 years at Vassar, as well as the demands of the next 4 decades you spend beyond this campus. It's a message once made familiar by the Beatles, those Northern English lads who embodied the power of four. Help. Help. Help! We need help. Your help. You must help. Please help. Please provide help. Please be willing to help. Help. And you will make a huge impact on the life of the street, the town, the country, and our planet. If only one out of four of each 100 of you choose to help on any given day, in any given cause, incredible things will happen in the world you live in. Help publicly, help privately, help in your actions by recycling and conserving and protecting, but help also in your attitude. Help make sense where sense has gone missing. Help bring reason and respect to discourse and debate. Help science to solve and faith to soothe. Help law bring justice until justice is commonplace. Help, and you will abolish apathy, the void which is so quickly filled by ignorance and evil. Life outside of college is just like life in it, one nutty thing after another, some of them horrible, but all interspersed with enough beauty and goodness to keep you going. That's your job, to keep going. Your duty is to help without ceasing. The art you create can glorify it. The science you pursue can prove its value. The law you practice can pass on its benefits. The faith you embrace will make it the earthly manifestation of your God. Here at Vassar, whatever your discipline, whatever your passion, you have already experienced the exhausting reality that there is always something going on, and there is always something to do. And most assuredly, you have sensed how effective and empowering it can be when more than 4 out of 100 make the same choice to help. You will always be able to help. So do it. Make peace where it is precious. Help plant trees. Help embrace diversity and celebrate differences. Help stop gridlock. In other words, help solve every problem we face. Every single one of them. With the power of 4 out of 100. Help, and we will save the world. If we don't help, it won't get done. Congratulations. Good luck, and thank you.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear. The hour I first believed, through many dangers, toils and snares, we have
see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That's all, folks.